Welcome to the next edition of our speaker series this month and the Patika Wealth Management Group. I'm John Patika Jr. and I'm alongside my father, senior member of our team, John Patika Sr. here. And our special guest who is making a repeat appearance here is Kurt Ryman. Kurt rejoined UBS back in 2024. He's our head of our fixed income at CIO Americas in New York after spending 10 years at BlackRock as a senior investment strategist. And Kurt was the head of our thematic research here at UBS for a long time. And we're happy to have him on and talk a little bit about the year ahead. Welcome, Kurt, to our call.
Thank you. Very delighted to be with you.
Hey, Kurt, we'll get right into it. We generally keep these to half an hour, as you know. So I'm just going to open it up with big picture for next year. What are you guys at CIO have in mind? I mean, economy, jobs, inflation. What do you have in mind for next year, big picture?
Yeah, next year, I would expect that the economy should remain decent, kind of like this year, maybe a touch slower. We're likely going to get some initial help from the excess withholding on income taxes for those groups that saw a tax adjustment in the One Big Beautiful Bill. So that'll be helpful in February, March, April of next year. Should give a little bit of a boost. AI CapEx, we think, is going to remain strong. So spending on chips and all the data center electrification needs and so forth should remain strong. So that helps investment. The labor market, also, you know, we've seen some modest increase in firings, but all in all, I think it's a relatively healthy labor market. Maybe some question as to how much that tax refund for lower income households gets spent, or if it gets used to pay down debt. If it's spent, that'll be just an incremental bonus for the economy. Inflation, I think we're all dealing with in our own separate ways. Issues around affordability, that's become a really important topic. It'll definitely be something we hear about during the midterm elections in November. But all of the fear about tariff-driven recessions and spikes in inflation have yet to really be felt in the way that was projected a year ago. And that's largely because economists were looking for something like a trade war. The U.S. raises tariff rates and other countries respond, but they haven't responded. So I think we've been spared the worst on inflation. It might move moderately higher. The Fed seems somewhat concerned, but not so concerned that it's stopping them from cutting interest rates. They did so yesterday. They're likely to do so again next year. There's a chance they do more than one additional rate cut next year. So I would say it's a steady economy, not a whole lot of concerns here about tail risks. But I would say that a lot of this hinges on the further CapEx in artificial intelligence build out. If that should falter, then there's maybe bigger concerns about a weaker than expected economy because so much is kind of riding on that. You know, the wealth from the stock market, the jobs that are involved in it, the spending itself. So we just have to stay as we all are. I mean, I think this is something that we're spending a lot more time on. All investors are, is just monitoring that build out. We're still constructive, but if you're looking for a source of risk, I think that's probably one area you want to look for.
You mentioned the Fed cutting the rates by 25 basis points yesterday. Let's talk a little bit more about that. You know, Trump has the ability, well, he's going to replace Powell at least in May, I think, when his term comes up even sooner. My guess is that means he's going to put someone in there who's going to really cut rates. What's your thoughts on that? And if they actually do go real hard on cutting rates, what's that going to mean?
Whoever the next Fed chair is, I would gather is going to remain focused on the dual mandate, stable prices and full employment. They're not going to want to jeopardize that. And the reason I say this is that we have a debt load that's, you know, closing in on $40 trillion. And the cost of the interest on that debt is going up as the bonds are maturing and being replaced. So interest costs are now in excess of defense spending. And that's usually a concerning sign. We've had some, this past year, we had one of the rating agencies downgraded the U.S. government. So now all three rating agencies have a below AAA rating on U.S. government debt. So I guess I'd say that matters. Long-term interest rates matter. Mortgage rates, auto loans, those are all going to cue off of long rates. So, you know, cutting rates is probably important. I think it's anyway going to happen, Powell or otherwise. We might get a bit more rate cuts, a bit more accommodation under a new Fed chair. We'll see. But it has to be justified by the labor market weakening or inflation popping out and coming back down again. Risking a de-anchoring of inflation expectations or a rise in interest rates that could spell higher interest costs, that's a problem. And I don't think the Fed chair wants any part of that. So I would expect further rate cuts. We also heard that the Fed is going to start increasing its balance sheet again by buying short-dated treasuries. This is an effort to replenish reserves in the system that had shown some signs of getting some scarcity of reserves. And that was a problem back in 2019. It shows up in short-term interest rates. So it's not only the long end of the curve, you know, mortgage rates and car loans. It's also liquidity, short-term funding. The Fed has been in a mode of getting policy back to neutral, both the balance sheet and rates. This is sort of that post-inflation period from 2021, 2022. They've mostly achieved that. Rates are now closer to neutral. The balance sheet is back at a level that's more in line, I think, with what the Fed's goals are. Now it's going to be more incremental. There were bigger changes in 2025 and in 2024. You know, the Fed will move, we think, this year ahead, but not as much as in the past years. And, you know, may move more than Powell, but directionally it's about the same, and they're not going to do anything to compromise the dual mandate.
They increase that balance sheet. That's a pretty big deal, right? I mean, you're putting more money out there. Is that going to be inflationary also? Do I get that wrong?
Yeah, so there's a big debate over the balance sheet and what size it should be. A number of the heir apparents to Powell who were up for nomination had some pretty strong views about where the balance sheet sort of final resting place should be. There's a big argument as to whether or not, you know, the Federal Reserve should own assets. And that wasn't something they did prior to the financial crisis. And maybe you could argue buying assets in the financial crisis and then again during the pandemic made sense for reasons related to liquidity and not allowing a, you know, financial market panic to become a full-blown system outage. But that when these problems were over, then the Fed would reverse those asset purchases and would no longer be involved in sustaining financial markets. Well, there's a new floor now. There's an entirely new regime for managing monetary policy. It's gone from one of scarce reserves, so you just have a minimum amount of reserves that you need to have liquidity in the financial system, to one where, you know, reserves are higher. They're what we call now ample. That's the Fed's new framework. And it's getting a little bit technical, but the point is that there are times now, because of this new regime, when replenishing reserves is necessary. It's sort of like maybe a gas tank analogy is appropriate here, but when reserves start to become depleted and you start seeing signs of stress in short-term money market accounts, then they have to step in, or at least they feel they have to step in. And this is one of those times. They don't want to have dislocations in short-term funding markets become, you know, a stress point or a fracture in the broader financial system. So they're kind of, you know, stopping in, adding some gas to the tank, I guess. But I don't think this is gas on that's going to lead to higher inflation. It's more of an effort to make sure that the financial system doesn't experience stresses. And these days, I think we have to be mindful, though, of the Fed doing potentially more than what they announced yesterday. Let's just keep in mind that the debt level is high, interest costs for the government are in a level that we haven't seen in generations. And the Fed doesn't want to see interest rates rise, nor does the administration. So we could be looking for more. And in this case, yes, I believe if you had the Fed coming in, stepping in, buying assets to prevent a sharper rise in interest rates, especially at the long end of the curve, that's something that I think we should be mindful of, potentially concerning either for higher inflation or a weakening of the dollar, one of the two, if not both. But for now, I would feel that this move that we had yesterday was really just kind of getting kind of a fine tuning of where reserve balances should be in this new regime.
All right, let's get off of that. That's I didn't like economics. So something I really want to talk about, though, is the tariffs. They did not create the cataclysm that we expect, not we, but some people expected. And the Supreme Court's going to make a decision probably here any day. What do you think?
They could have a decision before the end of the year. That would be pretty quick for the Supreme Court. You know, it's hard to say exactly, but before February of next year would seem pretty likely. So it's imminent. And the question here is really about, does the executive branch have the sweeping, almost universal power that has been used under this International Emergency Economic Powers Act statute to levy tariffs? They've taken many different forms. There's the ones that are against fentanyl and immigration, Brazil and India for different reasons. There are the baseline tariffs that the administration has levied against certain countries, 10 or 15%. And then there are these reciprocal tariffs, the greater tax, the ones that, you know, in some cases are, you know, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, even in the case of China, it was approaching 100%. So the administration is the defendant in the case. They've been taken to court in lower courts. The lower courts found the tariffs illegal. I won't go into all the details here, but it went all the way to the Supreme Court. Some cases were merged, and the plaintiffs are arguing that the administration doesn't have this authority, that tariff authority rests with Congress, that the IEEPA statute doesn't explicitly mention tariffs. And the government is arguing that regulating imports does involve tariffs, even if tariffs aren't mentioned in the statute. So how is the Supreme Court going to rule? I think most observers found the oral arguments that the justices were skeptical, and the betting markets or these prediction markets are indicating about a 1 in 4 chance that the court sides with the president. So what does this mean? Well, it's about $140 by our calculation, $140 billion of tariff revenue that's come in or will have come in by January or February that would be refunded to the plaintiffs and most likely all who paid the tariffs. That's a not insignificant windfall, you know, for companies that may have even adjusted prices higher. And so they'll get that rebate. They may even pass that back on down to consumers if they see fit to do so, or if they're even able to do so. If they were to see that these were illegal, the government would come in with brand new tariff authority right out of the gate. I'm sure they've aimed this out, and there are different statutes that the president can use to rebuild the tariff wall. They won't get all the way back to the tariff rates that exist now, but they'll get pretty close, and they'll have leverage. They've already done investigations on a number of different products and countries that they could roll out at a moment's notice to pressure countries into either not reversing the deals that they've made or follow through on the deals that they've made. So on balance, the way I would see this is, if they're declared illegal, there's a little bit of a fiscal windfall to the companies that pay the tariffs. That's a boost to the economy. The deficit would be slightly wider because that revenue would be foregone, but not by all of the reduction in the tariffs, because they're going to rebuild some. And it probably means inflation's a little bit, the tendency to come back down closer to where the Fed wants to see it. That raises the chances that we get more Fed rate cuts than is currently priced. So on balance, I think this means that the yield curve is a bit steeper, shorter rates falling, longer rates maybe a little bit higher. I don't think it's going to be such a thing that it's bad for the stock market. You mentioned, John, that it hasn't had that cataclysmic event for the economy, and it definitely hasn't for earnings. You know, S&P 500 company earnings have continued to move ahead. Even though the tariffs are higher, companies manage through this, whether it's inventories or pricing. And so if this gets reversed, I don't know that it's anyway going to be a big windfall for earnings. Some of these companies aren't that are going to get the rebates or the refunds aren't even in the S&P 500. Most of the Mag 7 companies didn't pay these tariffs, at least it was insignificant if it was part of their business. You know, if it gets reversed, I don't think it's going to tell us that the market's going to be on a tear because earnings are higher. But on balance, maybe a bit more limited, less chaotic tariff environment, I think the market will probably say, oh, that's a good thing, you know, all else equal. So a bit higher on stocks and slightly steeper yield curve is how we're thinking about it.
Okay, fair enough. Moving along, let's switch to AI. You guys in CIO have done a good job on this, guiding us on which direction to invest. And a lot of those stocks are high. I don't think it's a bubble. What do you think?
The AI story is going to get a little bit more nuanced as time goes on. We've been through this upswing in CapEx. It's been helping those that are selling the chips and all of the infrastructure around AI. And now the question becomes, are we going to start seeing increased use cases? Is there going to be a broader application of the AI in a way that is boosting productivity for the companies that are using it? And I think that's the big question. So it's not a bubble per se. That's maybe the wrong way to frame it, because the AI companies have done really well. Their earnings have been growing, especially the what we call the hyperscalers. You know, that's the data centers and the chips and so forth. Will we be able to see the revenues come through on the other side to match the investment spending that's going in? And we still are comfortable with that as kind of our base case for thinking about AI. But it does shift a little bit. It starts to move away from the infrastructure piece of getting the AI built out to the software, right? So what are the new either large language models or tailored models that are being used in business? You know, that's an altogether different set of companies. Some overlap, but there's different companies that are going to benefit from that move. And then there's the companies themselves that are maybe finding that they can either economize, cut costs, do things more efficiently. And that's kind of another element. So I think as an investor, we have to be mindful of moving along that path of development, you know, and have a diversified exposure. And I think another thought on this is that we can't just assume that this is going to be a U.S. technology with all U.S. winners. You know, it's global. We have to think globally on this. We've seen a number of advances coming out of China, other Asian economies. Certainly, Taiwan is a big purveyor of chips. So having a diversification of the exposure across the different sectors of benefit, also geographically, I think is important, that we're not just myopically centered on these Mag 7 companies. And then I would add to this, it's going to require a lot of data, but it's also going to require a lot of energy. And it's the investment in utilities. This is a new growth story. You know, utilities, typically, what do we think? Defensive, income producing. And utilities are now a growth story in a way that they haven't been for decades. And other sectors, like, for example, healthcare, new applications of the technology in a way that is accretive to the earnings of the companies that are developing either new gene therapies or other ways to improve life expectancy. And that's exciting. You know, so this is the typical evolution. I think we should be thinking, how does this apply across sectors and across geographies?
Kurt, you had a couple of different really cool reports that you guys came out with from your office, one on the Industrial Revolution and the other one on electricity. And you guys kind of likened it to what we're seeing with AI. Could you talk a little bit about those reports? I just think those were really fascinating, and how you guys had the research from those revolutions.
Yeah, so this is a really exciting new report series, and I'm glad that you mentioned it. We have been looking at AI, automation, gene therapies, robotics, all of these innovations, and so much innovation has happened in the United States over the course of the country's history. And we have the 250th birthday coming up in July. So something to look forward to, something to celebrate. And we wanted to go back in time and try to understand what does it mean to invest in innovation, and particularly through the lens of what has happened historically in the United States. So we started off with the railroad, the Transcontinental Railroad, almost 2,000 miles connected coast to coast, first time that's ever happened. It was a great example of all in. It was government working with businesses. Businesses, by the way, were at the forefront of this. I mean, a geographical and territorial amazing phenomenon, an engineering and logistical feat that is so exciting to look through. And now you read all these news articles about comparing AI with railroads back in the late 1800s. You know, the CapEx as a share of GDP during the railroad era rose to 6%. And you're not going to see anything quite like that in AI, but it's an important marker for kind of thinking about what's possible when a country goes all in on a particular technology. We then look to electrification, both the railroad and electricity. One thing you learn is it takes a long time for these new innovations to really catch a wave. You know, the adoption cycle takes time. It's either infrastructure or kind of the development of new ideas takes time for people to have an imagination about how transformational it's going to be. Factory floors had to be completely redesigned to take over these motors that were powered by electricity. They were steam before. It was completely redesigned. That then fed through into that other huge innovation, the assembly line, which is going to be a topic that we cover in January. But we're just going to keep checking these off, try to find out some learnings from before, contextualize it with investing today, talk about how are we positioned. The next one is going to be on aviation, followed by the assembly line, of course, the microchip and the internet and all sorts of other fantastic American inventions, and leading up to, you know, the 250th birthday in July. So more to come. It's an exciting report series. Glad you mentioned it. Thanks.
Good stuff. A couple more. We are getting short on time, but let's go backwards even further, like 10,000 years. Gold, silver. What do you think?
Yeah, still upside. Much less than this year. It's everybody became a gold bug in 2025. You know, those who had sworn it off and said, you know, we're not going to ever buy gold, and now it seems to be a core part of a diversified portfolio. So yeah, I mean, we're, depending on the day, our upside from, you know, current targets is much more limited. Next year we have it at 4,500, and by the end of next year, by December, we have it at 4,300. So very limited upside, and silver kind of topping out at around $60 an ounce before slipping back some to close out the year. So we've kind of maxed out. The reasons for this, I think, are starting to become obvious. I mean, once you get to these high price points, demand starts to get difficult for those areas that are big buyers of jewelry. Part of the story of why gold is, well, if interest costs are going down, if policy rates are going down, then the incentive to own gold might be good. But then the interest rates stop going down and the incentive to go into gold starts to dry up a bit. And then a key piece of these has been the weakness in the U.S. dollar. So gold and silver are denominated in the dollar, so a weaker dollar tends to be supportive of precious metals. The dollar had a pretty tough year in 2025. We don't think it's going to appreciate much, but it's now found a new floor and will likely hover there as opposed to weaken a lot further. So that takes another bit of the wind out of gold. But as a diversifier, it has started to show its worth. And I think that's one of the reasons why we should sustain our exposure, even though the upside isn't as great.
Two more quick ones. Bonds, Can we still invest in bonds and feel like we can make some money next year?
Sure. It's just not coming from a sharp drop in yield. It's more of an income generator. So you can build a high quality portfolio of fixed income with not a whole lot of interest rate risk. And you can pull from that, you know, call it a 4.75% yield. If you're starting to think about, you know, if you're in the higher income brackets, you can look at municipal bonds with an even more compelling yield on a tax adjusted basis. So yeah, I think it's fine. It's not going to be a strong year, but likewise, if the economy is strong or stable, better, and policy rates are moving slightly lower, so the Fed's cutting rates a bit, it's not a bad environment for bonds. You know, and your comparison too against stocks, we're looking for high single digit returns in 2026. So it's really more compressed returns across the board. We shouldn't expect it any differently from the bond market. I would just say, don't get over your ski tips. Don't get too unbalanced on bonds and go and try to hit, you know, these longer maturities, because I still have a bit of concern that longer interest rates could move higher, whether it's concerns about the debt load or that inflation isn't completely tamed, maybe some combination of both. So just be careful a little bit on longer maturities. That's not the case as much with munis, because those yields have kind of adjusted some for that. So but it's in areas like treasuries or corporates, I might keep a lower profile when it comes to longer maturities.
I know it's early, but midterms, thinking ahead a little bit, will that have an effect on the market?
It's a long way off. I don't know that it's going to directly impact the market, but you do find that the midterm years are the ones where stocks don't do as well. And you also find that when you shift from a united to a divided government, that tends to be not a strong year, but it doesn't mean bad things are going to happen. You know, it's just that the returns aren't quite as strong. And that's consistent with our overarching message. And we can't really guarantee that we're going to go to divided government, although I think, you know, if you were to take the polling numbers that you're seeing for the president's job approval and you were to correlate that or try to draw some relationship to how many seats are lost in the House, you'd find that lower approval ratings like this tend to coincide with more seats being lost. So that would be a reasonable guide. And some of these prediction markets are only saying about an 80% probability that we're still going to have united government at the end of the midterms. I think we are moving potentially either to a divided government scenario or one where maybe it's united, but the room for pushing policy through big policy might be more difficult. You know, it might be the same party also in control, but jockeying for 2028 might cause some in the party to kind of peel off and not vote in a united way. So, you know, I think there's much more limited room for big fiscal stimulus that's going to support the economy in the way that it was last year and into early this coming year.
I knew it was too early for all that, but one thing that isn't, you mentioned we're approaching 40 trillion. This is the last question, I promise. We're approaching 40 trillion in debt. Is there a breaking point? Is what am I supposed to watch on that thing so it doesn't jump up and catch us by surprise?
It's one of those things where there are solutions to get out of a debt problem, but it just takes political will. You look at the wealth that we have in the United States, and it's many multiples of the debt load. I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not talking about redistributing. I'm just saying that we have plenty of wealth in this country. Sometimes it requires tough choices. So it may mean longer working years or not getting certain benefits if you're at a particular income level, or what the compromises are. It's entitlement programs, it's tax and spending, and those levers you can pull. And over a 5 to 10 year window, you can make a big dent in the rise in the debt and maybe even bring it down. You know, the political will isn't there, and it may not be there because the bond market hasn't really put elected officials on red alert. And it might take the bond market to show policymakers that it's important. So what does that mean? 10-year note yields have to rise to 5% or 5.25%. And the stock market has to spit up blood. And that's the indication. That's the time that Congress and the president have to take this seriously. There are other ways, though. If we think about it, you know, the Fed was buying assets. I mentioned this earlier. They could buy assets yet again if interest rates rise. And, you know, it's either going to be inflationary or it's going to put pressure on the dollar. But those are tools that governments have used, could use again. It doesn't involve pain from the point of view of raising taxes. It's not causing, you know, elected officials a lot of pain because they're not solving the problem. But it does cause investors pain because you're getting bonds back that are at less purchasing power. If it was a dollar weakness story, then you're not going to get international investors being as willing to finance the U.S. debt. And so that's the pathway I would see of being the most reasonable. Either you have a rise in rates and it says to elected officials, all right, now we've got to really do something about this, or rates rise and the Fed gets involved by, you know, capping the degree to which interest rates rise. But then the dollar weakens and you might have higher inflation for a period.
Well, Kurt, we're getting close to the end of our time here, and we appreciate you jumping on with us before the holidays. It's somewhat scaring me about the debt. There was a lot of stuff, pretty wide ranging. And if anyone would like to have any of the Kurt's reports about those Industrial Revolution and the electricity, feel free to reach out to our team. We'll get that out to you. But before we wrap up, I mean, do you have any final thoughts here, Kurt, before we end the call?
Yeah. So keep in mind that we've had a pretty good run. Stocks have had three pretty impressive years in a row. Bonds have done pretty well. We had a nice run up. I mean, gold was one of the big outperformers. I think next year, you know, despite some of these concerns, we're going to still have a solid year. The economy looks to be pretty healthy. The Fed's cutting rates. There are concerns about valuations, but you need to have a problem with earnings before you have a real problem in the stock market. So yeah, we're looking for returns to be a little bit more compressed next year, but still should be a pretty good year overall. And I would wish you all a happy holiday.
All right, Kurt. Well, you enjoy your big ski trip with your family here, and everyone listening to the call too. We hope we have a happy and safe holidays, and that would conclude our call, and appreciate you joining us, Kurt.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thanks very much.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.